Great to have you with us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and I'd like to wish you, on behalf of both of us, a wonderful 2012. We certainly enjoyed having you with us over 2011, and we're looking forward to many more great shows with you joining in with your questions and comments with our guests. And our guest today is Peter Green with InfoStar. He visits us monthly to help with computer issues and problems, and he always has great information to share. Thanks for coming by, Peter.
Always great, and happy new year to everybody.
And, you know, it's kind of funny because we were just talking that we had planned to talk about recovery and backup today, and fortunately for us and unfortunately for Peter, he's been dealing with that exact issue in his work. So he's full of great ideas.
Well, when a topic is right at the front of my mind, there's a lot of material to cover.
Well, and it's a really important topic to cover. So I think whether it's ever actually happened to us or not, I think we all fear our computer dying and that we lose a bunch of material, especially now. So many of us have all of our photos on our computers, other things that used to maybe be, you know, in a drawer, in a photo album or something. Let's first talk about what some of the causes of computers crashing or hard drives dying and whether it's always a fatal condition.
Well, I'm going to give you a lot of people good food for thought on this one.
There'll be some New Year's resolutions coming out of this.
They should be. A lot of different scenarios can happen. One could be equipment failure, where simply it's an appliance, it breaks down. Another could be that there's actually no battery backup and you could have a brown or a blackout in the middle of using it, and it simply crashes a particular data file or an area on the hard drive. So in that case, you have to, you know, restore from a backup.
So you're talking about, like, if you say you're on a laptop and you're not plugged in and you run it all the way down as you're using it? Or what?
Sometimes that can cause, but that, you know, that's another possibility. That's kind of like a derivative of that. But you could be on a system in, you know, let's say in July, and for whatever, it's really hot, and the company's having a problem providing power, and we're having, you know, spikes or brownouts, things like that. Or power failure, and you're in the middle of doing something, whether you're editing a video file or an audio file or a picture, and the power just goes out. So, and you're not on a laptop, you're on a desktop, and it crashes the system. Could be a software bug. So it could be something as simple as a bug that was updated to you via the operating system, because Microsoft and Apple, and no system is immune to this, where they push and say, hey, we've got an update, and it happens to make your system malfunction and it crashes. Sometimes they're elegant crashes where nothing gets affected, and sometimes they're crashes where things
do get
affected.
Big fiery crashes.
Yeah. Yep. Setup files can get trashed too, which makes applications run incorrectly. Natural disaster, so flooding in our area could be one. Act of war, fire, theft. In that case, you know, whether or not it's videos that are important to you, pictures. You know what I've noticed? A lot of people taking pictures, but very few being printed or developed.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of memories disappear quickly. Music, accounting files, tax files, documents, resumes, etc. So if those are not backed up, they're potentially, you know, subject to loss. You could lose it. Could be a portable computer and you simply misplace it and lose it. Smartphone, same thing. Lack of knowledge. How does that one work? Poor knowledge by the user,
mm-hmm.
Or technician, where they inadvertently delete files. Encrypted data. If you lose your password, that's a tough one. That could be really very difficult to recover from.
Mm.
So, you know, there's a caution on, do you really want to encrypt your data in the event that something happens and you need to restore from that? That could be a very difficult act to follow and try and mm-hmm. recover from. And then disaster recovery services. Do you really want to experience, you know, going through that? Because that can be very costly. And the question mark is, are they able to actually recover what you've lost.
Right. And just to go back for a second, I think you mentioned bugs, but did you actually mention viruses? I mean, can viruses affect things?
I got to add that to my list.
The already long list of, of threats to our data.
Viruses and, you know, Trojans that can get on your system and potentially, you know, take your data, where we've heard, you know, in the news over the course of the past years where personal data has been stolen from different servers and, you know, corporations like Sony have had to shut down their, you know, their gaming sites because, you know, things have been compromised. So what do you do? How do you deal with that? Well, you learn. You learn by asking questions, or you hire somebody and you still ask questions, because hiring somebody doesn't necessarily mean that all the answers are all the questions are answered. You can purchase a service or a backup product and ask questions and learn more. For example, you buy a backup device and you're not sure how to use it and you read about it. You can call up and talk to tech support and you could say, here's what I use on my computer. And here's what I think I have on my system. You know, can you help me identify what I need to back up? How do I do it? And understand how you're doing it. You can go online and research your applications that you use. For example, Microsoft Word, which is popular, has changed their file extension many times over the years. And also, you have the option in the setup to go in there and actually direct it to where you want to back up your files, and you know, you should know those things. Otherwise, you're accepting what the system is doing out of the box for you, which is
And you're assuming that it's doing what you need it to do.
Correct, and that it's putting it in a place where you may have no clue, you know, how to get there. It's not a simple location. You have to know the tree structure of how to get there. So types of data files and extensions, what do they mean? Where are they located? How to redirect, you know, the saving of your data files, where that is in the software. For example, a program like Outlook Express, which has been very popular in Windows XP, for backing that up, you have to go within the program to change the folder where it's located. And if you've never done this before and you go into it and you look at it, the level that it's down, I believe, is like at least four, if not five, folders buried in your system's hard drive. So that's a heck of a path to have to follow, where you can actually simplify it, create a folder called data, and then within that call it Outlook Express or OE files, and then it resaves it to that location, and then you can back that up easily. Outlook, you can export a PS.PST file out, and you can save that, and you can tell it where you're saving that. So learn about the applications that you're using, what the data files are that are created. Now, how does Apple work with it? Apple has what they call Time Machine. It's very easy. It's on autopilot. Simply drill down and you can go back and grab the files that you need. Microsoft, a lot of people think that Microsoft Restore is the answer to that, and it actually just has to do with the operating system and the applications. It has nothing to do with the data files. In fact, when you do use a restore point to bring your system back to a time where it was working, and we've talked about this many times on the air, it has nothing to do with your data files. So they have a volume shadow copy that you can use. I link to that in my top 10 in terms of how to get that going. There are other backup programs out there. You can go to sites like CNET.com and look for reviews on it. I've talked about a free program called Yadis, Y-A-D-I-S. There are other programs out there that you can pay for. There are programs where you can turn on file versioning. So if you edit a file, it can keep saving, you know, different versions of that. There are network-attached storage devices that you can invest in. I've mentioned companies like D-Link, where you buy the box and it's set up to your router or your network, and then you just put in, you know, one or two hard drives. So you could buy one hard drive to start. You can add a second one. You can pick whatever size you want to put in there. There are other companies that have those kind of devices. There are services that are free and pay for web services, and I've linked to those over the years on my website. If you go to the Virus Info Center,
and there's that's infostar.com, and there's a link to that on the Facebook page. Again, infostar.com.
Yep. And then there are portable devices you can get. So there's USB or thumb drives, and there are portable hard drives that simply plug into the USB port or what's called an external SATA or FireWire or memory sticks. You could get solid-state hard drives if they're more expensive, they are faster, and there are no moving parts, so they tend to last longer. There's CDs and DVDs, but they're much slower. They're typically smaller in capacity, they're not as durable, and they're not as easy to transport. But, you know, let's say in the event that, you know, something happens to your system, if you use a web-based service, at least you're pushing stuff to what they call the cloud, to the internet,
right.
And it's at least it's off-site and it's protected by being at another location. But if you don't do anything, then you're subject to loss, and it's just pretty black and white.
And I think one of the important things to note, Peter, and you mentioned it kind of in passing, was you were talking about a data file. I mean, I think one of the issues is not all of us are as tidy on our computers as we might like to be in regular life and in virtual life.
And it takes time to learn this, but it's in your best interest.
And to also kind of discipline yourself, I think, you
yep.
know, to
mm-hmm.
make sure. So I think
I oversave.
Well, and also just to have a central place, like you were saying, the data, mm-hmm. the data folder, because then you know that anything that you want to save is in that folder. So mm-hmm. it's a matter of just copying that folder instead
right.
of thinking, oh, well, I have to make sure I remember to do this. And oh, and then there's this stuff that's sitting on the desktop.
Mm-hmm.
And so having a central place where, you know, it's kind of the umbrella file for mm-hmm. everything that you might want to save.
You know, I've had some people say, well, then it's too easy to find, so someone else can grab it. And I'm like, okay, you got a quandary here. You know, do you want to make it easier for yourself to do? Or you could, in essence, leave it the way all the default things are set up on your system and then program your backup software to go out there and grab it from wherever it is and make it difficult. Or you can just make it easier and keep it in a central, you know, hierarchy where data is your main folder and then store things based on, you know, video, music, and so forth. So, you know, whatever you choose to do something.
Right.
Choose to be proactive versus doing nothing. The end result is, if it's gone, it really is gone.
Well, and I think also thinking of all, you did a great job of laying out all of the many possible worst case scenarios and thinking about what are you protecting against? Because say you have a thumb drive and you put all of your data on it, but then you keep it in the drawer of the desk that your laptop or desktop is sitting on. So if something happens, whether it's fire or, you know, flood or whatever, it's going to be affected too because it's in the same place.
Right.
Whereas if you're more worried about, say, you know, the hard drive crashing or something, maybe it's not as big a deal that the external hard drive is kept in the same desk. So thinking about, you know, what are you trying to protect against and how are you trying to be most safe, I think will be kind of a good rules.
I left one other important thing out, that if you're working with software where the data needs to be verified before it's actually backed up, and that's typically in a database environment, make sure you verify it, because your system backup is only as good as its last good backup. And if you don't go through the verification process, you could be going on for months and then all of a sudden discover there's a problem. And they say, well, you got to go back to your last known good backup, and you keep going back and back and back and back and end up learning that you've lost months of work mm-hmm. because you didn't have a verified backup.
That mean exactly, that it's verified?
Well, there are some companies that require that it's almost like a reshuffling of the cards is what I call it, so that everything's real tidy. And if things don't match up with their algorithms when they're verifying the data, the formulas that they use or the matching up process that they use to verify that everything's in the right proper order, in the right proper place, if it doesn't go through that, their program can't see what it needs to in order to operate properly. Therefore, it doesn't work. So unless it goes through their certification of being a valid backup, you don't really know. And not all programs require that, but again, it's a learning process. You know, what are you using, and learn, you know, what is important as related to the data files. The picture file is a picture file. Video, audio, same thing. But in a business environment, you might be using a database application where it might be Oracle, it might be FileMaker, or any of the other, or it could be even a custom database application. And in that case, typically the programmers and developers, if you talk to them, they'll tell you what are the important files, how to clone a system, how to, you know, make it so it works on another, you know, setup. Mm-hmm. What files are the important files? So, and I've been going through an actual custom development system, and at the top of my list is, okay, these backups that we talked about making, they're not writing to where we told them, you know, what do we need to do to fix that? And how often are we able to do it? How does it affect system performance if we do it in the middle of the day? Is it necessary? How do we clone the system so we can test drive it on another computer without affecting, you know, the real data that we're about to use, and things like that?
You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show on Wisconsin Public Radio's Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry today and talking with Peter Green from Infostar.com. He visits with us monthly to help with your personal computer problems. We are talking about personal computers with Peter Green. And Peter, we have quite a few people who have been waiting oh so patiently to talk with you. So let's go to the phones. And let's go to Jerry in Appleton first. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Judith. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Hey, I am calling because we bought a laptop for our 13-year-old daughter for Christmas, and 4 days later, she had a birthday party, and a couple of her friends broke the laptop screen. It's not physically broken, but when you turn it on, you know, the screen, the images are all jumbled, and you can't use it. However, when you connect the laptop to an external monitor,
then it works fine.
Yes.
So what?
Well, we took it to the retailer that we bought it from, and you know they said it was broken, and that it would be the same to buy a new one. So we looked at that, and then we did some research on the internet, and it appears that we could either buy a screen that will work, and it looks fairly easy to repair it ourselves, or send it to somebody who can repair it. And, you know, the cost could be anywhere from $100 to $150 versus spending, you know, over $300 to have the retailer repair it.
So, Peter, let's find out what Peter thinks about that.
If you feel competent, you know, try to buy the part and see if you can do it yourself. The other option is after you attempt to do that, you know, hopefully you keep things pretty well in order. The next step would be to send it to somebody and say, here, you know, put it back together.
Okay. Are there any sites that you would recommend, or places that you would recommend who can repair this?
And you're in the Appleton area, right, Jerry?
Yes. It could be anywhere in Wisconsin. The site that looks good to us is actually located in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Who's the manufacturer of the...
It's an HP Pavilion.
HP Pavilion. You know, one is to check with, you know, if you go to HP... You can probably find where their service centers are.
Okay.
That would be a way to check and see who are people that know how to work with HP parts. One of the little quirks about working with computers and also with cars is sometimes these manufacturers create a part that needs a tool or knowledge of how to open or close or remove or, you know, make it turn the right way so you can gain access to some other piece that allows you to detach, you know, what you're trying to unhook or fix. You could also go on YouTube and look and see if anyone's, you know, repaired the same laptop that you have. You know, that's another option.
Yep, and we did go there.
Did you find anything?
We did, yeah. Mm-hmm. We found it through this site that's in Arizona. It's called mm-hmm. Green Surgeons, and then he links us to a YouTube site for
okay.
it.
Okay. Also on eBay, some of the sellers on eBay are good about showing you how to do something because they're selling you the part. So they share the information with you about how to take the part out, put the new one in. I know, like, the dash in one of my cars is a digital dash, and they explain how to take it out and put it back in, and they sell you the reconditioned part. So it's in their best interest to, you know, make it work for you.
Well, it sounds like that's, if you're up to the challenge, Jerry, it sounds like something you could try doing yourself. So,
and occasionally you can find people locally. You know, you just have to maybe do a little bit better online searching to see if there's someone competent locally that can work with it.
Great. Thanks for that call. And let's go right away to Marge in Clark County next. Hi, Marge.
Hi. My problem is I bought myself a new computer, and it's being, most of the things are being switched over from my old computer. And I'm moving from XP to Windows 7. So I'm wondering where to find a good resource for learning about Windows 7.
Okay. Couple of things. One is you could simply go to the library. I'm sure they have some Windows 7 books there. The other is you could go on, if you have access to online, so you're hooked up to the internet.
Yes.
There are some good sites. You just have to Google for them, look for some video 7 tutorials. You could go to probably YouTube would have some good tutorials to, you know, videos to show you some of the basics getting around. I believe the guy's name is David Pogue, P-O-G-U-E. He writes the Missing Manual series, and it's typically what they call the manual that they forgot to include with the box.
So the stuff you wish you knew that they don't actually bother to tell you.
Yep. So you can look for a book like that, which would, I don't want to say, you know, Windows 7 for Dummies, but you get a little bit better insight into what's going on with Dave. He's written he and his crew have written quite a series of books on a wide variety of computer products and gadgets.
And also, I would check the local community college because they often have continuing education classes
so
that are very reasonable.
You can probably find like some shorter mini courses mm-hmm. that might be for like 2, 4, maybe 6 nights,
right.
You know, a couple hours to give you some, you know, introductory mm-hmm. Work on that.
I see. Are there a few things that are generally a problem for somebody who's, I'm visually impaired for one thing, and so therefore I don't drive, and
okay.
It creates a problem of getting to places. Problems in general that in making the change, things that are generally a problem between the two operating systems.
Typically, it's the software changes that you've been accustomed to. So, for example, the latest version of the browsers like Firefox and Internet Explorer, they're going to look different because they can be upgraded to the newest, latest version versus on XP, you can't do that. So the look and feel, how those programs operate are going to be different. So if they're, you know, the applications that you use typically they're upgraded to the next level that is supported by Windows 7 that wouldn't be able to run on XP. So that's where you're going to run into the differences, and that's where it just takes time to probably, you know, study and feel your way around.
So as you were talking about backups, mm-hmm. will the XP backups work on the Windows 7?
There is a backup on Windows 7 that you can run. So, you know, whether or not you set it up to work or, you know, you have someone set up to work, at least, you know, copying those files to an external device that is put in a safe place. Or, you know, there are other programs that you can acquire, whether or not you download them and purchase them or, you know, someone goes out and buys it for you and puts it on your system. So, I guess it's whatever your personal preference is in terms of, you know, what you use for your backup.
But if I have the same program moved mm-hmm. from the XT
seven,
and then I take my thumb drive backup and use it on the new one, will mm-hmm. is that expected to work?
Well, that's a good question, because there could be some compatibility issues between running software that was on XP and Windows 7. Windows 7 has what's called, depending upon the version that you have, it has what's called a Windows XP compatibility mode. So if it's reinstalled and it's working fine, then you're okay. And if it's not, then you might need to upgrade it. And the, you know, one thing that we didn't mention in the earlier discussion about backups is verifying your backup. In other words, you've made a backup, go and look at it occasionally and see if it's actually there.
Don't just assume that what you think is
right.
there is there.
And what's nice about the Mac version of backing up the timetables, you can actually very easily drill down into the folder and the file mm-hmm. level and see what you have.
Time Machine generally will also warn you if you haven't backed up in a while.
Correct. And there are systems like that in the Windows environment. It's just that, you know, you have to, it's not part of mm-hmm. the operating system.
Right. Well, good luck with that, Marge. And speaking of backup, we have a couple people who have questions about that. So let's just go back to the phone to Greg in Milwaukee. Hi, Greg.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have had a couple of USB external hard drives fail. And my understanding is that if someone were to disconnect them during a file transfer, the whole drive becomes useless. And that seems to be what happened. Once it was somebody else was using my drive, another time it was actually connected with a time capsule, and I think there was a disconnection there. And so my question is a FireWire external drive more robust than USB in that regard? In other words, if there's some sort of failure during a FireWire transfer, am I more likely to actually at least save the drive, if not that particular file?
You know, that's a good question, but it's really, you know, the FireWire and the USB are simply the interface between the two devices. And FireWire actually originated from the Apple world, and it was a means of backing up typically large video files. So they wanted a conduit or a path that was at a higher speed. And now the newer versions of USB and FireWire are very comparable in terms of speed.
And what is a FireWire exactly?
It's just an interface between two devices. Okay. So they handshake each other. They see each other. Handshake is when two devices see each other. So when you plug in a cable from a FireWire device to a computer, or it could be to a video camera mm-hmm. or whatever, they handshake and they see each other. They acknowledge that there is an actual device attached to it.
So you're actually going directly from one to the other instead
Correct.
Of through like a third
Correct.
Party. Okay.
Same thing with USB. And there was, you know, USB 1, USB 2, and so forth. So, and then they changed the capacity or rate at which the data transfers or moves between the two connections. So they've really kind of grown up, and not all computers have FireWire, and a lot of them have USB. FireWire is not as popular, but In the Mac world, it is there. In the PC world, in some systems, it's there. ESATSATA is also another external connection that you might see. In terms of the drive failing, or if you want to taking a dump or whatever you want to call it, you know, where it dumps out files that are no longer valid and trashing the drive. It happens typically it'll happen if you're pulling it out in the middle of while it's trying to write a file. And if it's trying to write a large file, that's going to be more typical than not, because it's trying to establish drive locations for a large file, and it's hanging itself out there, and then all of a sudden, you know, everything's retracted, so it doesn't know where things belong, and then you get a lot of fragmented files, you know, on that drive. So I wouldn't say USB or FireWire are more susceptible to, you know, either one having problems. It's having bad luck, you know, disconnecting in the middle of a backup or a write to to an externally connected drive.
So it sounds like the thing to avoid is interrupting that process.
Correct.
Okay.
Yep. And right. And you know, even doing like a cancel on a large transfer can still create, you know, those spewed
it's
out.
It's still an
fragment.
Interruption, even if
yeah,
it's a
it's
more planned
interruption. Yep.
Okay. Well, good luck with that, Greg. We are talking with Peter Green of InfoStar today. He visits with us monthly to help with your personal computer problems. And you can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email your questions to talk@wpr.org. Chris Molina is our on-air producer today. He will get your calls and emails into us, and we would love to hear from you. Pete in Melrose is next. Hi, Pete. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Pete. What's your question?
I backed up my. I have Windows XP, and I backed it up with the backup, whatever was on it, onto an external drive or hard drive or whatever. And then then of course my hard drive went down, and I went in to try to get it, and I downloaded it, but every file has an NOC on it, and I can't open it up or get it.
All right. So what is, Peter, what is the NOC file extension?
NOC. I'm not sure what that means, but I know there are, I've linked to in the past, I think fileext.com. There are sites out there that will define what those extensions mean. What files did you know, when you say they changed or they're .NOC, what are you actually looking for?
I was looking to put all my information back onto the new hard drives that I had put in.
Okay, so did you know, I mean, what were you backing up? What kind of...
I went in just... into whatever was downloaded on my computer as a backup.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, it took most of the day for some odd reason to do it.
Okay.
And now, obviously, I told you what happened. And even every picture has that on the end of it, so I can't open up my pictures.
Hmm.
I was just trying to Google it, and it looks like a no objection certificate, but it's not really clear what it means. And so this just happened recently, Pete, for the first time?
Yes.
What would you recommend, Pete?
Well, if you know what the who the data files belong to, in other words, what application they belong to, what I typically try is to rename the file so that it fits the application. So in the case of, you know, and hopefully it had been written in the format that's required by the application to look at it. So for example, if it's a Word document and it's .doc or whatever version you're using, you rename the file to the, you know, you copy a version of the questionable file to the file name and extension that you think it belongs to, and then try to open it that way. There are some utilities out there that I've worked with which will do conversions, and you have to look for them, but it will take like damaged files or questionable files and try to work with it to restore it. That's another avenue you can take. But knowing who the files belong to, what application was used to create those data files is probably the most important thing. And then whether or not you go on the company's website and look and see if there are some tools that can work with restored files, or you know, how to convert those .noc files to, you know, some usable format. Mm-hmm. That's the next best, you know, thing that I would try.
Okay. Well, see, the guy who put the new hard drives in,
mm-hmm.
he had an Windows XP, and he tried to open them up with that backup, mm-hmm. and he couldn't do it. And he was surprised that everything has that on it. That was safe.
Wow.
And he didn't know the computers for a living, and then he didn't know where to go with it.
Yeah. Well, that was part of the earlier discussion was, you know, after you do a backup is to validate that backup, make sure that you know that it works. And in this case, if you're, you know, accepting it, you know, face value that the backup that you were running was working, and now you're discovering that, in fact, it didn't work, which is unfortunate.
Well, good luck with that, Pete, and give us a follow-up if you find out what caused it and what the NOC means, because if someone else runs into that, it would be good to know. No, let's go next to Chuck in Juneau. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just now, while I was listening to you, I was Googled that NOC file extension, and there are a number of Google hits, so maybe he should just Google around a little bit. My question is, are you still there?
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, my question is, I'm backing up files. It's funny that this program should have come on, because I was just doing that when the program came on. And I've been using my outdated technique of just, I have Windows XP Pro, and I just go to Windows Explorer and I copy files that I think that I have modified in these folders that I remember putting them in, and I copy them to my external hard drive. But that is very time-consuming and not the best, and I don't know how I would verify them other than actually physically opening them up one by one. Is there a program that I can download onto my machine that would automatically back up files that were modified since my last backup? I'm looking in here at the Microsoft website, and it talks about backing up the files from their control panel in system and maintenance, and backup and restore. Is that what I want, or is there a program you could suggest that would only back up files that have been modified since the last backup?
Sure. There's a couple of ways to do it. One is you could look at some of those, you know, if you're attached to the internet and you want something offsite, because it sounds to me like you're doing it localized. So one option is to look at some of those services that I've linked to on the infostar.com virus info center page. So if you go down to backups, you'll see a whole bunch of links and you can check out. And there are free services, and there are some that are pretty inexpensive, like $60 for the year. But the other option is there are backup programs out there, and I've tested one that I've used is called Yadis, Y-A-D-I-S. And I know it works in XP, works in Vista, Windows 7. And you can basically change it so it will just back up whatever you modified. It'll overwrite. You could do file versioning. So there are a lot of options. You can schedule it. You don't have to have it sitting in your system tray. You could just click it on and say, hey, I want to do backup, and then run it. You could stop it at any time. You could start it at any time. So that's one option. And the other is you can buy some of these external hard drives, and they come with backup programs included in the system, you know, specifically for that purpose as well. So I don't want to call it plug and play, but that's the concept behind it, is you plug in the external drive, and on that drive, they ship it with a backup program to step you through that.
I never thought of looking in there. I always just used Explorer. Thank you for that. just a question for you real quick. On those online backup systems, uh-huh. I've always been a little afraid of that. I mean, I just don't know where my data is going to end up. Who are they going to sell it to or whatever, you know?
Well, you know, I guess one is reading the fine print. One is that, you know, it's being stored in a location that's behind your, you know, if you want to call it your lock and key with your username, your login, you're entrusting them with, you know, safely storing that for you. But the flip side of that is, what happens if something happens, you know, like people say, God forbid, you know, there's a natural disaster, or there's theft, or there's fire, or something that's beyond your control, and it's no longer at your location. It's no longer physically in front of you. At least you have something to go back to. So, you know, looking at the
offsite backup.
Yeah. And, you know, it's something that's easily pushed online. And again, it's only the version or the file that's changed, and not, you know, constantly redoing the, it's only, like you said, only doing the ones that have changed.
And so, just so everyone knows, I just put a link up to Yadis, the online link where you can download it. And so there's a link to that on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page as a comment to the status for today's show. And it's codeessentials.com is the main website. And then there's a Yadis backup page, so we have a direct link to that. So thanks for that call, Chuck. And you are listening to The Larry Mueller Show on the Wisconsin Public Radio Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry today and talking with Peter Green of InfoStar. He visits with us monthly to help with your personal computer problems. You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234 or emailing talk@wpr.org. Happy to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller. And just want to let you know, tomorrow at 11, I'll be talking with the author of How Carrots Won the Trojan War, Curious but True Stories of Common Vegetables. And then tomorrow at 11:45, we'll learn about the life and legacy of Wisconsin resident Elizabeth Zimmerman, who revolutionized American knitting. But today we're talking about personal computers with Peter Green of InfoStar. And Peter, as always, there are a bunch of people that would like to join the conversation, so let's go back to the phone. Mary in South Range is next. Hi, Mary.
Good morning.
Hi.
I have a Dell PC. I have a DVD in the drive. It will not open, nor will it play. And I've gone through the computer thing of eject through the other screens, and it seems like it's a mechanical thing, like it's trying to read it but can't.
Okay. Usually, and I'm pretty sure it's probably there, do you see a really tiny hole on the drive?
Okay.
In the front part. It should be like almost like a pinhole, something that a paper clip could fit through if it was straightened out.
And I do what?
What you do is you take a paper clip, straighten it out, okay. And you can actually push it into that hole,
uh-huh.
And it should allow you to open up or eject the drive.
Okay.
As far as what's going on with it, the computer, well, it could be mechanical. It could be something just, you know, in terms of the operating system trying to deal with it, and it's got a problem reading the actual disk itself. So it's kind of created a confused state. So by getting it out of the drive and then shutting down your system and bringing it back up again may correct it, or it may continue to be flaky. You don't know until you try it. But there's usually a little pinhole that this paper clip can fit through, and you just push it straight through, and you'll feel some resistance, and the resistance is what you need to push on in order to get the tray to actually open.
Okay.
Now, if that does not if that's not there, then trying to, you know, grab it around the edges and pulling it out straightly, you know, firm and pulling it back and out might help and might work. But usually on Windows machines, they have that little hole that you can engage. On Apple's, it's a little bit more of a challenge. I haven't quite figured that one out because there are cases.
If I try that and it doesn't work, then I assume I'm off to the computer store.
The only other thing is, and this has been going on for a while, in other words,
it's been working fine until this last time. It's been
so,
working
okay.
Fine.
You might want to shut it down, and when you bring it back up, see if you can go into Windows Explorer and then click on your computer, and you should be able to see that drive. And then if you right mouse click on it and then click eject and see if that works.
Very good. Thank you for your help.
Yep. Good
sure.
luck.
Good luck with that, Mary. And let's go right to Brian in Fond du Lac next. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Judith. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
I have two laptops using a small business, and they're both running Windows 7 Pro. And at the end of the business day, what I would like to do is sync some of the data files between the two PCs. And I'm wondering if there's an easy way to do that.
So when you say sync the data files, obviously one of them has got to be... So you want to sync it so that you're almost like making a mirror copy of each one? So they're both the same, or...?
Right. Like, it doesn't need to be everything on the computer. Just say there's a bunch of documents in the My Documents folder.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be two people working on them during the day.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, I want both of those My Documents folders to be a mirror copy of each other. So in case one computer craps out, everything on the other one is fine.
Mm-hmm.
Brian, are these computers networked to each other?
Yes, they are.
Mm-hmm. Well, you could use a program like Yadis to just, you know, redirect them across the network to you know, as long as you're sharing... You provide shared access to the drives or even a folder. So in other words, you create a folder on each system, and you could call it, you know, whatever you want. You could call it shared folder. You could call it networked folder. You could call it main backup folder, and then just simply redirect across the network the backup program on each machine to write those files to their respective locations.
Okay.
Do you follow the...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
So basically, instead of... I mean, they'd be working on their own computer, but the documents would automatically be going to a more central...
Right. So you could also give them names. So if your laptop has a name for the user, you could name that file on that system the name of the other user on the other system so that you know...
What's coming from where.
Correct.
Yeah. Right. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks for your help.
Yep.
Hey, thanks, Brian. And let's go to Jack and Hurley. Hi, Jack.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good.
Listen, I have a problem with downloading or transferring files onto an MP3 from my Apple. And when I put the M3P in the port to download it, nothing seems to get recognized. Nothing is recognized on the screen. That there's something there. I put my camera in it, it recognizes it.
So it's actually not seeing the MP3 player when you plug it in?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Peter, what do you think might be going on with that?
So is it, so you're hooking it up to an Apple system?
My Apple MacBook, yeah.
Okay. And it's not able to, so are you transferring the files from your MP3 player to the Apple?
I want to transfer from the Apple to the MP3.
Okay. Do you know what kind of MP3 player is it?
Well, I got two different kinds.
Okay.
I thought one of them was broke. That's why I got another one, and both of them don't record it. Yeah.
Okay.
And what brand are they?
I would take a look at them. I got them from China. They're Chinese. I really can't tell.
Okay.
It's very small.
Well, what
size of a silver dollar?
Hey, are these files from Apple's iTunes?
Yes, they are.
Yeah, you may have a problem playing them on that MP3 player because someone can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe when Apple allows you to download those files to their environment, unless there is an iTunes player on the device, like an iPod or an iPad or an iPhone, that it's looking for the licensed user that owns the files that have been downloaded in the Apple iTunes environment to allow you to play it. Otherwise, it's technically encrypted in their system.
So maybe a good thing for Jack to try is to find someone with, say, an iPod or an iTouch or something and see if when he plugs it in, if he's able to.
But he would
transfer.
Have to be the user of the well, you could try it. But
yeah.
I'm just saying that it sounds to me like that's what's going on in this scenario of trying to have an Apple device talk to a non-compliant Apple mm-hmm. device.
Okay. It's the Larry Mueller Show on Wisconsin Public Radio's Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, talking with Peter Green about your computer questions. Computers can be a tool, a toy, or sometimes both at the same time. But however we use them, it can be hard to keep up with the latest news and product releases. Do you feel like you're keeping up with new developments or worry that you might be missing out on helpful improvements? Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Happy to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Peter Green of InfoStar is here until 12:30 to give us advice and to answer your questions. He'll also share this month's top 10 list of useful websites. Peter's put together great sites that focus on everything from finance to health and lots more in between. What questions do you have for Peter? I hope you'll join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And don't forget our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. While you're there, if you like the page, you'll receive regular updates on upcoming show topics. Stay tuned. We'll be back right after the news. So happy to have you along for this, our first show of 2012. Happy to have you with us today to talk with Peter Green, who is with InfoStar.com. He comes by every month to share his expertise and advice with all of us about personal computer problems. And at this time, every month, Peter shares his current top 10 list. And we do have folks waiting to talk with you on the phone, Peter, but we'll get to them shortly. I want to make sure that we get to the top 10 list. You put together a really interesting combination of sites this month. What are some of your favorites?
Well, the first one, if you go to InfoStar.com, click on current, or if you click on the top 10 archives and go to today's date, you'll find them all there.
And there's a link from our Facebook page, too.
Okay. The first one is kioskea.net. It's kioskea.net. And it's just an interesting technology site with useful forums, and they've got a link to the error codes in Windows, so if you ever see those, and I'm dealing with some. And then also the actual source from Microsoft, I list that as well. The next one is called socialnetbar.com. So if you're into Facebook, Gmail, and searching this app, it's on the Mac and it's coming to Windows. Might be something you might be interested in looking at. The next one is a personal finance blog. Person claims to be a personal finance junkie and just might be something of interest to people that like to save and invest, and it's called saving2invest.com. This next one, it's nice to see organizations put out, to me, domain names instead of using, you know, this/that and so forth. It's just, you know, pay the $10-$15 and put a domain name out there for what it is. And this one is NFLhealthandsafety.com, and it just basically is support for the players and families on health and safety issues for the sport, you know, so it's pretty straightforward. Mm-hmm. Number five has to be, to me, in this day and age of looking for information and data on the web, one of the most simplistic ways of getting to it. It's called contactingthecongress.org. All you have to do is click on the state and who you're looking for, and you're there. You've got access to everything. So Everything's up there for how to contact your senator or congresspeople. Number six is Constitutional Rights Foundation. It's nonprofit for basically instilling in our nation's youth a deeper understanding of citizenship and understanding our Constitution, the Bill of Rights. It's crf.usa.org. The next one is slideshare.net, and there's free and pro versions, but it's a way to do presentations, documents, and videos online, and you could use it to promote yourself or your business.
That one sounds really interesting, yep. Actually.
And the next one is tomshardware.com. It's a tech site, tech portal that's been online for a very long time. Mayo Clinic is the next one, which has got some excellent medical resources that they have created and posted. And number 10 is, to me, it should be, I don't know if you want to call it MicrosoftAnswers.com or AnswersMicrosoft, whatever, but it's called Answers.Microsoft.com, and it's a searchable tech resource for probably most of Microsoft's consumer products. But if you want to answer a question or post a question, you have to sign in for it.
And is that just a free registration?
Yep.
Great.
So those are the top 10.
Great. And as we said, you can find that by going to infostar.com and clicking on the current top 10 list. There's also a direct link to that page from our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. And Peter, we have several people waiting to talk with you. So let's go right back to the phone. Jerry in Waukesha is next. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, how's it going? Hi.
Good.
You had a previous caller about trying to back information up, and I'm backing all my system files to my hard. I'm back to my hard drive, and that hard drive is getting full. I keep on getting like an error message saying that I can't back up anymore because the backup system is full. So my question is like, how do I go about expanding or adding more space to that drive?
So this is an external hard drive that you're using to back up?
No, it's like an internal. It's on my hard drive.
Oh, okay.
So it's like...
So you're actually writing it to the same drive?
Yeah, it's my backup is the D drive. It's the D drive on my... On the actual machine.
Uh-huh.
And I have like 17 gigabytes. I want to... How do I go about it? Maybe change that and add it and increase it to 7 and increase it to like 20 gigabytes.
Well, if it's a secondary drive in your computer, the only way to really gain more space on that is to do some file management where, you examine the files that are on that drive and decide which ones you want really need to keep and which ones you should remove. That's how I would look at a secondary drive where I'm writing backup files to.
And having an internal second drive as your backup.
It makes it run faster, but again, everything's localized, so you can easily retrieve it and you can easily do the act of backing up, but it doesn't save you from if something happens to that computer or if, either drive fails, then again, it's still localized. Mm-hmm. There's no other choice.
It's all in one basket.
Right.
Yeah, so preferably I should actually have an external backup.
Yeah, the external device will allow you to remove it and put it in a different location, or you'll have a lot higher, larger capacity. The interesting thing that we left out of this entire discussion is the fact that Thailand was hit with a lot of bad weather, a lot of rain, a lot of flooding, and it's elevated the cost of hard drives, but it hasn't made them, to me, priced them so they're so astronomical that you can't buy them. It's just that it's raised the price temporarily on the cost of buying one, but...
And that's if you're going with the actual external hardware
correct solution.
Well, if you're doing a cloud solution.
If you're doing a cloud solution, it's probably the capacity is out there if you need it. It's just a matter of deciding how much you need.
All right. Oh, good luck with that, Jerry. And next, let's go to Bob in Madison. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
Hi.
question for you. Over the holidays, I was trying to replace a hard drive on my mom's notebook, and it did not recognize that the drive was there. I've done this before, so it's not that I'm going in completely blind on it, but it refused to acknowledge that there was a hard drive there. It was a used drive from a reliable source, because it needs an IDE drive, which isn't so easy to buy new these days. Would it have something to do with the way it might have been formatted before? Or, because usually when I've done it before, Ubuntu just formats it as it's there, but this one didn't even, you know, when it started the setup process, you know, it checked off that, you know, there was no hard drive present.
You know, in the IDE setup with hard drives, usually you have to deal with slave and masters. Did you get past that part?
Yeah. I mean, it was, yeah, I mean, I took the, I mean, it would, this would be a master drive, so I took the jumper out of there.
Mm-hmm. So, and you were sure about cable connections and all that stuff, too.
No cable.
Okay. Did you?
A notebook.
Okay. Did you try using it in another system?
That wasn't an option for me at the time.
Okay. Usually when I have problems like that, I try to reconfirm that the drive is operational in another system. You know, it's kind of like backtracking and trying to figure out, okay, is the problem inherent in the system I'm working on, or is the problem inherent in the device that I'm working with? And the only way to eliminate that it's not the problem with the device I'm working with is to see if it works in another system that's similar.
Didn't have a spare notebook to try it out.
Right. Yeah, I understand that. The other thing that you could try and do is, you know, depending upon time-wise, what kind of time you have, I know you can go online, and I've done this, where you can either go to eBay or find a supplier where you can buy a case that will allow you to set up that drive as an external drive.
Okay.
And see if it's operational as an external drive, then you're confirming that the drive is operational.
Okay, but you don't think it had anything to do with how it might have been formatted before, that it was...
Which version of Windows, or which version of operating system you're working with for the drive?
I'm going to guess that the drive I got at Swap was Windows. I would be installing Ubuntu on it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Again, I've done them before, and it hasn't been a problem.
Right.
It formats it. But.
Well, yeah. Well, one of the things, if the drive is operational, physically, the computer, logically, it should be able to see it if it's operational. In other words, it's acknowledging that the drive is there. So you may want to simply... You know, even if you want to use it for a Linux operating system, just at its roots, you could just try and see if you can talk to the drive by partitioning it, just to get it to acknowledge that the hardware physically sees it. That's one accomplishment. Then going beyond that is a matter of how to talk to it through the OS that you're using. So unless there's some kind of switch setting on the drive itself to change how it's being talked to, or unless they did something in the process where they put it out for people to buy from Swap, that, you know, the person that was using it there and did whatever they did to remove the data actually, you know, damaged the drive. The only way to test that is to try and put it in an environment where you can at least talk to the drive physically, and then logically try to establish connection through the OS.
All right. Good luck with that, Bob. And actually, you were just talking about partitioning, and Gary in Green Bay had emailed, on a new Windows PC, commonly there are three partitions on the hard disk, a system partition, the C drive partition, and a recovery partition. How important is it to back up all the partitions, and what do they do?
The system partition is space that's allocated by the operating system for its things. C is the space that you use, plus it puts the rest of the Windows OS out there. And then the recovery partition is one that you really should leave alone. In terms of backing it up, I would just focus on really what you're using for your data files, because typically when you have to recover from a system crash, you're going to have to reinstall the OS and the applications.
So it sounds like mainly the C drive partition is what you want to back up?
Yep.
Okay, great. Thanks for that email, Gary.
And there's also the shadow volume tool I linked to on the top 10 is another way of backing up your system that Microsoft doesn't really promote, but it's out there and it's part of the Windows 7 environment.
All right. Let's go to Brent in Menominee next. Hi, Brent.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
We get our external web through a DSL system, and I came into, was inherited a, what is called a 5-port 10/100 switch. And I'm wondering if I can hook my printers and my external hard drive to that and improve service versus using a Belkin USB port.
Well, the only way you can hook up to that 5-port 10/100 switch is if you actually have network connections on those devices. The Belkin USB device that you're talking about is using the USB as connectivity, or the conduit between your computer and those devices that are using USB. The switch actually uses local area network cables to plug into those ports, which means that you need what are called 10BASE-T or Ethernet ports on your printers or anything else that you want to hook up to it.
Okay, so that's not an option.
Not an option unless you happen to have devices that have those
kind of ports.
Right, okay. Yep.
Okay, would this improve, in other words, I had those telephone type, or what do you call it, Ethernet connections on my laptop and hard drives.
Right.
I mean on the computers.
Mm-hmm.
If I put this switch in, is that going to help service at all? For the computers,
If you put that switch in terms of, basically what that switch does is it allows communication between the devices at the rate of 10 megabits per second or 100 megabits per second. The fastest switches would be 1,000 megabits per second. However, if the cards in those devices don't go up to that speed, then they're only going to be as fast as what the switch can handle. So, for example, if your computer's got a 10/100 and you put in a 1,000 megabit switch, it won't go that fast because it can only support 10 or 100. So,
like if you're driving a car that can only go 80 miles an hour, even if the speed limit's 120, you're not going to get up there.
That's right. Okay. Yeah. So, it doesn't really make things perform better or faster unless you're matching, you know, higher speeds with higher speeds. And the devices have to be, I don't want to say set up to talk to each other, but if you have one computer trying to talk to another computer, they have to be set up in the same work group. So you would have to tell them that they both belong to the same work group. And then if you want access to different drives, you need to make those drives shared or accessible to each other.
Great. Thanks for that call, Brent. And let's go next to Dale in Green Bay. Hi, Dale.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is, I put a wireless router in a couple weeks ago in my house. It's a Cisco router.
Okay.
It works on all the computers in the laptops and that except my netbook.
Okay.
When I plug the netbook, I'm getting a signal because I talked to my ISP and they pinged it, and you can tell that I'm getting a signal, but I can't open any web browsers. I tried Chrome and Explorer. If I plug it into the back of the router, you know, and just use a cable connection, it works fine, but wirelessly I can't open any of the web browsers.
And you said it's just your netbook that you're having the problem with?
Yeah, it's just my netbook because my wife's got an older laptop. That works fine. My kids are home. They have, one of them has a Windows laptop. The other one has a MacBook. That worked fine. So it's just that netbook.
Hmm. What would I do? I'd probably go online and look at asking the question, poor performance netbook wireless access, and see if there are any settings to that you might want to look at changing on the netbook in terms of performance. Another thing I would look at and see, how old's a netbook?
It's about 3 years old.
Yeah, the other thing I would look at is probably going to the manufacturer's website and seeing if there's a fix to the wireless network.
So there might be a patch that's
there.
Might
be a patch because it might be a known problem.
We've got the same router in my office. That's why I thought, well, I'll just buy this one. But mm-hmm. it works in my office, but it doesn't work at home.
Oh, that's interesting. I don't
know what the difference is.
So it works in your office.
Yep. But I never checked the security settings. I have it in the highest security settings at home. I don't mm-hmm. know if we have a lower one at the office.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you might want to see if, you know, like you say you have the same router in your office as you do at home.
Yep.
Is it the same version of the firmware?
It might be different because I just bought the one like 3 weeks ago that's in my house.
Yeah, you might want to
a year ago.
You might want to check because I've seen issues where different versions of firmware can cause problems too. And you know, you don't know why, but
yep.
that's how they interact with each other. So it's worth checking into.
Okay.
All right, thanks for that call, Dale. And Kurt in Watertown is next. Hi, Kurt.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Happy New Year. So
you too.
My question is, I have about a year-old laptop, and I'm running Windows 7 Home Edition, and about a month ago, for some reason, it stopped taking updates, and what happens is it'll just go through the process of trying to configure the updates. It times out after X amount of minutes, tells me it can't configure those Windows updates, sets it back to where it was apparently, and then when I reboot my computer, it's just incredibly slow, and it goes through that process again and again and again. And I'm wondering if I need to reinstall my operating system or what I can do to try to get this figured out.
Which version of Windows are you using?
It's Home Edition.
Home Edition.
So I believe it's 7 Home Edition.
Okay. Do you know if you have Service Pack 1 installed on it?
You know, I don't.
Okay. What you might want to try doing is go to, you could probably search for it, but they have Service Pack 1 out for Windows 7, is to actually download the entire file.
Okay.
And then apply that as the, you know, the update to see if that fix, you know, do it localized.
Okay.
There might be something that's just stepping in the way while you're doing the download process that it's not allowing you to complete it. What I would probably before doing the update is I'm just thinking if you might want to run do you have an SSD drive on your system or is it just a regular hard drive?
Just a regular hard drive.
Yeah. You may see
if SSD is solid state.
Right. Yeah. To run some just simple housekeeping stuff like disk defragmentation. And, you know, seeing if those kind of things go through without any problems before you apply the update.
How long are you, do you know how long it's been since it's been getting updates, Kurt?
Well, it seems to be within the past month. And the other interesting thing that happened is I did have one episode where I got the blue screen with a kernel issue, you know, mm-hmm. And by the time I got done reading it, my computer, you know, just rebooted itself.
Right.
And then that's kind of when this thing started to happen. So I've run the standard diagnostics, but I haven't done anything like this, you know, like you said, the defragmentation and stuff like that.
Yeah. The other thing is if the system continues to misbehave is to look at like a Windows 7 repair, you know, where the operating system validates the operating system files to make sure everything is in proper order. So that's another thing you can do an online search for and perform as well.
All right. Good luck with that, Kurt. And in just the last couple seconds here, Peter, how often should we back up?
As often as you feel comfortable, you know, being susceptible to losing something.
All right.
It's really, you know.
individual.
That's the comfort zone.
All right. Peter Green with InfoStar comes by every month to talk with us about personal computer issues. It's always the first Monday of the month, and he will be here on February 6th. So tune in then. Stay tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for a lot more interesting programming. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Thanks for listening.